So welcome to our second lecture. For those of you who were here last week, we started last week by introducing the concept of compassionate understanding and what it means to be a Christian person who wants to help others or a Christian counsellor. We spoke about a number of things. We spoke about listening skills. We spoke about we spoke about, like I said, compassionate understanding. We spoke about examples. We spoke about the woman at the well. We spoke about various things that our Lord did in his life to clearly demonstrate that he is the perfect counsellor and that he is our model. We spoke about non-judgment. We spoke about humility. For those of you who weren't here, I apologise, we didn't bring a copy of last week's notes with us, but we'll bring some next week so you can get... No, I could have brought it. So we'll bring some next week so you can get a copy of last week's notes. Also, if you weren't here last week, there's a list of names on the table there. Just please make sure that your details are on there. It just allows us to email you information and updates as they happen, if there's any changes or what's coming up next and all those sorts of things. Having said that, if you were on the list last week and your email was there and you didn't get an email from me today... if you haven't checked your email, it's okay, but if you didn't get one, it probably means that your email's wrong. So just, if you could kindly just make sure that your details are correct for those of you who have their details already there. So tonight is the second lecture of our 10-week lecture series, and tonight we're actually going to start to talk about the practical side of counselling and the steps that we can take and what we can start to do with people who approach us with issues. I've set out the notes that you've got in a similar style to last week, so if you want to jot down notes, you can, or if you're happy with the brief notes that you've got there, it's okay. And today, we're going to talk about a model in counselling that's actually called the helping model. It comes from the idea that, you know, if someone comes and asks you for help, they want help. They're not coming because... you know, they just want to talk about something. It comes from the philosophy that if a person is coming to sit down and talk about an issue, then they want it resolved. Now, that's not always true, but in the cases where it is true, this model works really well. And what we'll do tonight is we'll talk about the steps and the stages of this model, how they work, and then we'll spend a lot of our time talking about empathy. It's quite a lengthy lecture tonight, so we might not have as long a break as we did last week in the middle, but we'll see how things go. If in the middle of anything you feel like you're getting lost or things are not very clear, please feel free to just raise your hand and let me know. Just come on this side, please, just so I don't have to. Thank you. So the stages and the steps are the first things that we're going to talk about. And when a client comes to see a counsellor, they're even though they set the agenda, they decide what they're going to talk about. They decide what's going to happen in the course of, you know, the relationship between the counsellor and the client or between yourself as someone that's helping them and what and how you're going to help them. The actual framework, the skeleton in the back of what's going on is very much decided upon by the counsellor themselves. And so this model gives us a bit of a framework about what actually happens. And the first stage is to actually sit down with the person and to work out, well, what's going on? What is the problems or what are the issues? What are the concerns? What is the underdeveloped opportunities maybe that need to be worked on? So if someone is coming to you and saying, you know, I just want to talk to you because I'm feeling really sad, that doesn't really tell us what the issue is. It tells us that they're feeling sad and we can be empathic to that. But what this model talks about is actually going a little bit deeper. You know, the first step of this first stage is actually to help the client tell their stories, to help the person that's coming to you to tell you what it is, how it is in their life that they got to the point where they are now. Some people believe that a person's history doesn't matter, you know, like that if their childhood and how they grew up, it has no relevance, we just deal with the problem at hand. And there are some schools in counselling and in psychology that think that way, but the majority of the time, a person's history and where they've come from and how they've gotten to this point in their life has a lot of information and a lot of keys about how they can actually resolve the issue that's at hand. So the first stage of this first step is helping them tell their stories, making the environment that they're in a comfortable one, being open and responsive to the person, showing empathy, which, like I said, we're going to talk about a lot more. And then the second step in the first stage is to actually help the client break through what's called blind spots and prevent them from seeing themselves, their problem situations, and their unexplored opportunities as they really are. What sometimes happens is people think in what I call this fatalistic thinking. Everything's a disaster. You know, we wanted to buy the house, we didn't get the house, it's just an absolute disaster, we're going to have nowhere to live, life is just terrible, and there's no way that we can cope with all this amount of rejection in our life. You know, last week I spoke to you about how different people can have two different perspectives about the very same thing. And a similar, these blind spots are a similar concept in that a person can be so set in the way that they're thinking, so negative about what's happening in their life, or seeing it in one particular way, that they're completely oblivious to maybe other opportunities or other things that might be happening in their life. So the first stage in this what's going on, or the second step in this what's going on stage, is to actually start to look at, well, what's missing in this picture? This is what you believe, but is this really it? Or is there other pieces that maybe you're not seeing? And we'll talk practically about how to do that. And then this third step in this first stage of what's going on is to actually help the person choose the right problems or opportunities to work on. So when you have a young person that's coming to you and says to you, you know what, my mother yells all the time and I get so frustrated and I get so angry at the fact that my parents are always fighting and my house is like a war, and that's what an issue they talk about. And then the next minute they talk to you about, well, you know what, I don't know what to do. I've just started drinking and I've started just going out with my friends and I've just started to avoid my life at home. I've got to be wise in deciding what issue do I tackle here. Is that person really able to change their environment? Or is it a more worthwhile opportunity to actually start to explore how they're coping with the situation that they're in? So in working out what's going on, it's important to actually work out what the issues or what the actual problem is that we're going to work through. So that's the first stage in the helping model. Does anyone have any questions about that? It sounds very simple. It's almost put, especially in your notes, in a very simplistic way. But when you actually start to do it, when you start to talk to someone about their life and their story and where they've come from and how it is they've gotten to this point, that in and of itself usually takes care of about 80% of the problem. Because as a person speaks and as a person starts to tell you things, they start to realise things that they maybe haven't seen before. As you help them identify blind spots and as you encourage them to see things from a different angle, you know, very tentatively, very calmly, in a very gentle way, they can then start to explore things that they might not have thought about before. So this first stage of this helping model is crucial to its success. And then from there we go on to the next stage, and stage number two is, what do I need or want? What does this person really want? And what do I want my life to look like? What changes would make me happier? A lot of the times I say to my client, okay, well, what brings you here to see me is usually my first question. And then a few questions down the track, I'd say something to them like, if, you know, I could wave a magic wand and life would look like any way you want, what would it look like? Their answer to that question is often the key to what they really want and what they believe is good and bad and healthy and unhealthy in their life. Trying to establish with the person that you're talking to what it is that they want. Because I might be sitting there and really desperately wanting this person to change their eating habits, for example, but they're focused on their aggression and their frustration and their anger towards their parents. So I'll be fighting a losing battle because that's not what's on their agenda. That's not what they want to work on. It's not what they see as the issue. And it's often what people see as the issue and what it is that they want to work on, what it is that they want to improve in their life, is usually the thing that is really causing them the most pain. And from there, they're then able to tackle other things. And so sometimes what we need to do is to actually help the client use their imagination to spell out possibilities for a better future. So things like, you know, well, if you could have your life look in any way, shape or form, what would it look like? Helping them to use their imagination to start to actually bring in some reality and some perspective to where it is that they're headed. So if a person says, you know, I like this girl, this example that we've used earlier, who comes from a really troublesome, angry home, says, well, in a perfect world, I'll just have, you know, my parents would not fight and life would be beautiful and I'd have friends that I can rely on and I'd stop drinking. I would be like, okay, my next question would be, well, what are the things in this picture that you have influence over and what is it that you don't? So helping them use their imagination to spell out possibilities, but the very next step is to actually help them choose realistic and challenging goals for them to achieve. There's no point in trying to change her parents if that's not something that's achievable by her. And then the final step of this stage is to actually help them find incentives so that it will help them commit themselves to their agenda. So, well, you know, what's in it for you? So if you have this life that you want, or if you resolve this issue that you're facing, then what's at the end of that? What's that going to do for you? And suddenly the person can start to say, well, I'll have peace, or I'll have calm, or I'll be happy, or I'll be more financially secure, or I'll have a better relationship with God, or life will be simpler. And they suddenly start to have their own incentives and their own motivation. They go from someone who started off telling you a story with fatalistic thinking and everything's a disaster to someone who now has a bit of hope and has a bit of goals and some opportunities that they think that they can start to explore. And then the final stage of the helping model is, well, what do you have to do to get to where you want to actually start to help them to see and to plan where it is that they want to go and how it is that they will get there. So, you know, things that are discussed are possible actions. You know, you help the client see that there are many different ways of achieving their goals. So that, you know, continuing with that same example, we can say, well, okay, well, you know, one of the things you said you want to do is to stop drinking. Well, how do you plan on doing that? How is that going to happen in your life? And to start to, again, bring in some realistic and achievable goals for them. And also helping them choose best fit strategies, things that work in their life, things that they are able to do. There's no point in trying to get someone to do something that's outside their capabilities because they will then have a sense of failure and it will seem like it's just not going to happen. So they may give up. So being realistic about choosing a best fit strategy for them. And then you actually need to help the client craft a plan. Actually get pen to paper and sit down and say, okay, well, how is it that you're going to achieve this step by step? What do you believe needs to happen over the next few months? And if you notice throughout this whole model, at no point in time does the person helping sit there and say, well, this is what you need to do, or this is what needs to happen. It needs to come from the person themselves. Last week we spoke about advice giving, and we spoke a bit about the fact that when people come and ask for advice, a lot of the time they already know. And when people give them advice, they tend to do either the complete opposite or completely ignore the advice. Because it's not really advice that they're after. It's more that they need empathy and they need a place to balance their thoughts on and someone to be able to receive them empathically and have unconditional positive regard for them. And then the final stage of this model is, well, how do I get results? How do I turn this planning and this goal setting results to outcomes or accomplishments? And how do I get to that, and how do I then keep going? And that's pretty much the last stage. And so, like I say, on paper, and maybe as I'm explaining to you, it seems very simplistic. But in the next part of this lecture, we're going to start to talk about, well, how do I actually do these steps? What are some of the skills that I need to have in order to make this model a successful one? And it's not as simple as it may sound. The first thing that needs to happen is throughout these stages, there needs to be this question of how are we going, this continuous evaluation of the process happening in the back of your mind as you're helping this person. Has this turned into a situation where we're just kind of telling stories and ranting and raving and we're sitting together and crying about something and not resolving anything? Then maybe we need to stop and backtrack and start to actually talk about the issue at hand. Or are we actually progressing well? Are we following this framework? Not to the letter, but at least it's there and we have some kind of guideline as to where we go. Having said that, there are some things that come in the way of what's called therapeutic communication. In order for two people to have a relationship where there is therapy, where there is healing, where there is a resolve of an issue, there are some things that need not be there. And only some of them I listed. It looks like a long list in front of you, but it's really not. It's actually quite a brief list. I think in the lectures at the Theological College, the list was a bit longer than this, but I've cut it down for simplicity. And the first and biggest barrier to communication in this way is giving advice. If someone comes to me and says, you know, I have a problem with my parents, and the first thing out of my mouth is like, yes, I remember being your age and I used to have problems with my parents and this is what I think you should do, I've lost that person. Because immediately I've said to them, one, I know better than you. Two, my experiences are exactly the same as yours. And I've completely disregarded their feelings and disregarded the fact that they're coming to tell me about a situation and an issue that's unique to them. I've taken it and I've made it very general. So the first thing that quickly ends any kind of therapeutic communication is advice giving. The second thing, which I think in our community we're quite good at doing, sadly, is giving false reassurance. You know, this notion that, oh, look, you know, don't worry about it. I know this is upsetting you right now, but in 10 years' time, you're going to look back on this and it's really not going to make that much of a difference. And the person wants to look at you and say, well, I'm not in 10 years' time, I'm today, and today this is an issue in my life. And what happens, giving false assurance, is usually met with frustration and anger. And the next one is topic jumping. I know that this is an important thing for you, but I think it's far more important that we talk about this. And what I'm saying to the person is, your opinion doesn't matter here. Again, I'm the superior one. I'm the one that's going to tell you what's important and what we should and shouldn't talk about. And then the next thing, I'm so good at doing this one, interrupting. I have this theory that I know what people are going to say. So usually if you have a conversation with me outside of my counselling room, so inside my counselling room, I usually try to put on my counselling hat on and I'm really focused on this one particularly, but outside of my counselling room, I'll always try to finish your sentences. I'm terrible at it. Because I feel like I can guess what you're going to say and I want to see if I'm right or wrong. And I've discovered the hard way that in a therapeutic relationship, in a counselling relationship, where actually I'm trying to help someone, that hinders the relationship. Because it tells the person that, again, I know better than you, and not just that, what I have to say is more important, or I know what you think. And at times people stop me and go, no, that's not what I was going to say. I was going to say something completely different. That's where a relationship exists. Where a relationship doesn't exist, sometimes they go, oh, yeah, okay, fine, and walk away. So interrupting and finishing people's sentences. Being judgmental, we spoke about this in great depth and length last week, but, you know, that the fact that the one person that came to this earth had authority to judge and so many times chose not to, I think is the biggest testament to us that we need to avoid judging others. If he could stand there and choose not to judge people in situations where he could easily have and he would have had every right to, he knew that by doing that, that would damage them at that point in their life. Judging others, being judgmental, damages a person. Blaming. And I'm not just talking about here blaming the person you're speaking to, but, for example, look, all of this stuff that happened to you, that's because of the way you were raised and how your parents raised you. And I think if you just try to overcome the fact that it was your parents that raised you, and maybe if you think about it as if it was someone else, then this would all be over. Laying blame for whatever situation it is never resolves it. Never gets to the issue at hand. It always assigns responsibility to someone else or something else so we can just feel better about it. But it doesn't actually fix it. Giving directions is similar to giving advice. Or the next one is excessive questioning. The thing about counselling, it's not about detail. It's not about someone sitting there and telling me what they wore, what they ate, who they spoke to, and what did she say back to you. It's about the person and about what they feel is important to tell me. The detail, and I think the more we talk about these things and the more we talk about these different models and how we help people, you'll come to realise that the detail is really unimportant. What we want to focus on is how the person perceives or feels or thinks in a certain situation. And that needs to become the focus, because we can get easily bogged down in the detail and lost in the detail and then unable to move forward in the relationship. Excessive questioning. We've spoken about challenging. No. This isn't the way it is. It should be really like this. How could you respond in that way? How could you say that? Why would you say that? The minute you put the word should into a sentence, you've inflicted guilt upon someone. You've suddenly said to the person that you've done something wrong. And depending on that person's personality type and how they see the world, that can be very, very damaging. So challenging, although it has a place in counselling, it doesn't really have a place in a therapeutic communication. And expressing disapproval. You know, they're sitting there going, you really, really should not have behaved in that. I'm so disappointed in you. I can tell you the number of times, there are many, but the number of times in my own life where that's happened and has left a massive scar. Because I would think, I have this relationship with this person where I think so highly of them, I respect them to the point that I lay out my soul, I tell them all my secrets, and I respect their opinion of me, and suddenly they tell me they're disappointed in me, then where do I go from here? If they're disappointed, then God must be disappointed, then I must be failing. The next one is hurried approaches. You know, okay, that's fine, that's great, we've got 10 minutes, let's just get through this, and let's go on to the next topic because we really don't have a lot of time. You know, a good counselling relationship is limited by time. A session, or you know, the amount of time even you spend with someone is going to be finite. It's going to have a beginning and an end. But my approach to that time limit, my approach to how much time I give a person, can be in a hurried way where I just want to, yep, let's just get this over and done with. We've spoken. We've talked about what we need to. Let's just move on. Or it can be, I'm really aware of the time. I really know we don't have much time left, and I want to make sure that you're okay before we leave each other and we meet again. I'm saying the same thing in two very completely different ways. But the two ways that I'm saying it have a very different impact also on the person that I'm dealing with. Closed-mindedness and stereotyped responses. I don't know if I need to even explain that now, do I? But, you know, I'm sure you guys know this. Of course a woman would say that, you know, is one response. Very stereotypical. Well, he's a man, what would he know? Yeah. These stereotypical responses where we just assign blame to a whole group or cluster of people, or we, you know, say, oh, no, that's really wrong, and there's no way that should happen in our culture or in the way that we think or in our religion, etc., 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 suddenly puts the person to feel like, oh, okay, well, maybe I don't belong here. Maybe a church isn't a place where I want to be sharing my deepest, darkest secrets, because obviously they think that I don't fit in or that I'm wrong or that there's something wrong in the way that I speak or dress, etc., etc., etc. And the next one is double messages. Yeah, sure, I'm interested. Uh-huh. Right. My body language is saying one thing and the words coming out of my mouth are completely different. I'm telling you that I'm interested, but I'm looking away, I'm watching the clock, I'm daydreaming about something else. Yeah, I'm listening. What were you were saying again? Completely double messages. Defending or defensive responses. A lot of the times when there is a subject that's being discussed, when someone sits in front, especially early in my counselling years, when someone would sit in front of me and, for example, they'd have an issue with, let's say, a priest where they've responded to something in a way that my client didn't feel was right, I would have this hate inside of me that I want to defend and I want to say, no, but you don't understand where he's coming from, or maybe he means it in this way. And I quickly discovered that by doing that, I don't allow the person to reach that conclusion for themselves. Because what can happen is I've actually shut the door to them starting to explore that thing that they're upset about. They'll go, oh, well, yeah, of course she doesn't get it. Of course she's going to be on his side. Rather than them stopping and thinking, well, what is it about this situation that maybe I didn't see it you know, in the correct way or in its intended way. Self-preoccupation or daydreaming. You know, last week I spoke to you guys about the need to be honest about where I am in my life. The need to be really clear about when I am able to help someone and when I am able to be present with someone and when I'm not. And so if I'm in a state in my life where I'm going through a major issue or there is a struggle in my life and I know that my personality, I'm not able to help someone else in that situation, I'm going to be sitting there thinking about myself and daydreaming about my issues or the holiday that I'm about to go on or whatever the case may be. And the person that I'm communicating with will quickly pick that up and will realize that I'm not really interested in what they have to say. And the last thing, which is really common in dealing with especially younger people, is this sense of patronizing. You know, that, well, you know, I'm older than you, so I know better. And even to a six-year-old, that would hurt. That would be like, she doesn't really understand me. And maybe a six-year-old might not have the ability to articulate that, but that's how they would probably feel. So there's some barriers. There's some things that come in the way of any kind of therapeutic relationship, this model and others. But having said that, there are some things that a person actually needs to do in order to be able to have a healthy communication with the person in front of them. So we're going to go through a lot of these things, and I'm hoping that we're going to be able to actually get some practice time tonight in regards to some of these. And the first thing is our body language. I remember being at college, and I remember very clearly our first session about empathy and our first session about this model, and this is the basis of all counselling, and I was sitting there in a circle like this. And very attentive, I was listening, I was really concentrated, but I was sitting like this. And one of the things that we're going to talk about is our body language and being having an open posture. And the minute that I was told that I need to have an open posture, my hand went up and I was like, yeah, but you don't understand, like, in my culture, how I've grown up, when someone actually sits there and folds their arms and gives you this look, it means that they're really concentrating, you've got their full attention. And as I was saying it, I realised that I'm sitting amongst a group of people who are not from the same culture, that's number one. And number two, that's how I see things. It's not necessarily how they see things. And it's not really about me. It's about how I will be perceived. So a lot of this stuff initially felt uncomfortable, and especially the body language side of it. But I realised that it's actually true, that it doesn't really matter how I myself think I'm being projected to the person in front of me. It's what they see that matters, how they perceive it. And so in your notes, you've got something called solar, and it talks about how a person needs to actually appear physically in order to be perceived as being open and responsive and visibly tuning in to a person. Because you can have my undivided attention on the phone, but you wouldn't really know except for my response. Whereas if you see me face to face, my body language says a lot to you about whether I'm listening to you, whether I'm really being attentive to you, or whether I'm somewhere else. And so the first thing, we might actually get... Is there another chair in here? Yeah, there's another chair. I'll get a chair. There we go. So, Ramonda, you can be my volunteer. I know your name. Oh, you're not going to do anything. You're just going to sit there. Take a seat. Take. I might get you to sit here. So, yeah. Okay. So, the first thing is, is it going to fall? No. Okay. I have a habit of falling off chairs. I actually need to be facing my client squarely. So if you can see from your angle, you can actually see that there's a square here. You know, she's at an angle, but that's okay. What's going to happen is eventually as she talks, you won't need to, she'll automatically start to shift in this way. She'll actually start to move more towards my direction. And as the conversation gets deeper, we'll be even more square. I need to adopt an open posture. You know, I need to be I need to appear open and willing to receive whatever it is that she's got to say. You know, if I sit like this, she doesn't have my full attention. You do. Right? Even if I sit like this, she knows I'm kind of out there somewhere. The only way she'll know that she's got me and she's got my attention is if I look her in the eye. And I'm not meaning that I stare at her. Right? I'm saying I communicate with her physically at a level that she's comfortable with. I tune into her and into her own body language. So if she is sitting there and she's really closed up and she's got her arms crossed and she's really upset, I'll give her some space. You know, I'll still be attentive to her. I'll still be, you know, almost square but not completely to the point that she feels confronted. Lean forward. And it's not like this. Yeah, it's not like, tell me what's going on. It's more a gentle thing. And again, you'll find that as you get into a deeper conversation with someone, when we talk about empathy, you will see this naturally, physically. When a person starts to talk about a deeper emotion, when they start to talk about a deeper issue, they tend to slump forward a little bit. So what I'm doing is I'm subconsciously to her, giving her permission to do that. I'm not examining her. I'm not sitting so square that I'm in control of the show. I have a somewhat relaxed posture and I'm leaning slightly into her. And maintaining good eye contact isn't about, like I said, isn't about staring at her and saying, okay, well, what's up? You know, talk to me. Because she'll be like, no way. But it's about having eye contact where she's comfortable. She feels that she's got my attention, but she doesn't feel like she's locked into this gaze where she can't dare look away. Good eye contact is actually giving the person space and looking away at times when they need that space. And it's something that happens with practice, with time. And you do all of that while you're relaxed. You know, the most important thing, the most difficult thing, is to be focused, is to be here, to be present, to be sitting in this way, but at the same time, be really relaxed. And you can see why sitting like this, even though I'm concentrating, doesn't even reflect the way that she's sitting in the chair. One of the things about good physical communication is what eventually happens in a good counselling relationship, in a good healing relationship, in a good helping relationship, where you will find yourself starting to mirror her own body language. Subconsciously, it just kind of starts to happen. As you talk more, you'll see that as she slumps, if she leans forward, I move back a little bit to give her that space. You know, or if she goes completely back, then I move back too. I allow her that room. There is that flexibility in the relationship. And to be completely honest with you guys, initially this all seemed like a bit like, yeah, really? Like, does any of this really matter? But it does. Because before I say anything, she already has an impression about what I'm going to say by the way that I'm sitting with her. If I'm sitting behind a desk and there's stuff in front of me and there's my laptop and there are my books and there's all these things, I'm sitting behind the desk implies to her that I'm the professional here, you're the one coming to seek help, and I'm going to diagnose you. A good helping relationship, a good counselling relationship can't be from behind the desk. It needs to be open, there needs to be no barriers. Any questions on the body language? That wasn't too bad. Wait till we talk about issues then. And that... Yeah, sorry, you have a question? I didn't see you.
How definitive is this like body language rule?
Okay, so it's not, you know, it's not set in concrete. But what I have found over the years that in the times when even I'm tired and my body language is more slumped and I'm not really there, it does have an impact on the relationship. It does have an impact on the conversation. Because you could see in the way that we were sitting, she had my full attention. And I think if I was sitting in any other way, she would have sensed that I'm not. If I had crossed my legs, you know, to her that might have appeared like I'm being casual or disrespectful or I'm not really there. I've closed off a part of me. But sitting in that open posture and sitting in that inviting way allows her to feel comfortable to talk. So it's not sitting concrete, but I believe it's extremely important.
Majority of cases?
Absolutely, almost all cases.
Because, yeah, I guess it depends on the person, how they're going to view what
yeah.
you do, right?
And that's what I was saying to you. At some stage in the relationship, I will start to mirror her body language. So if a person comes in and they're really closed up and they're really defensive and they really don't want to talk, I'm not going to be leaning forward like this. I'm going to be sitting back. I'm still going to have an open posture, which just gives them, you can talk about anything, you can say anything, but I'm not going to invade their space. I might move the chairs further away, but I'll still maintain that open, solo posture.
Further on, do you then alter your actions according to what you know about the person? Because...
like I was saying, as the relationship progresses, without even knowing it, you start to mirror that person. So the next thing I want to talk about, and this is probably going to be the core of tonight, is empathy, both basic empathy and advanced empathy. And I think because we probably don't want to have too many interruptions between those, we might just take a 5-minute break now for anyone that needs to do anything in the next 5 minutes. If you haven't already added your names to the list, please do that now. And then we'll come back and we'll start to get into empathy and we'll start to do some practice and we'll start to actually talk about more of the practical side of this model. And empathy is actually underlying to all counselling, all helping models. So we'll do that. So let's take 5 minutes and then we'll come back and talk some more. We might start again, if that's okay with everyone. Yeah. Okay. All right, so we might get in back into this. One of the things that we were talking about briefly in regards to the barriers of therapeutic communication about the point about giving false assurances. And we were talking about how a lot of times, especially in the church, people say, it's okay, pray about it, it'll be okay, it'll go away. Or, you know, pray and ask Pope Corollus and you'll be healed. And making such final statements, such definitive statements, and giving such assurances to people can actually be very, very, very damaging. Because the person can start to feel, well, what's wrong with me? I haven't had the miracle. I haven't been healed. The problem hasn't gone away. There must be something wrong with me. And it further adds to the situation that they're in, rather than alleviating or helping them resolve the problem that they're facing. So I think it's a very, very common one in our culture, and I think it's one we really need to be aware of, because I think we've gone into a stage where we do it without even noticing. We do it without even realizing. You know, this is happening in your life because your spiritual life isn't good enough. You know, and who are we to make such judgments and such statements about people? Because that, like I say, can be very damaging and can actually be very counterproductive in resolving the issue that a person has. But we want to talk about the positives, and we want to talk about what it is that we can do. And the verse that you've got there, it talks about empathy. And although the word empathy in and of itself isn't mentioned in the Bible, there are so many things and so many stories and so many situations in the Bible where empathy is so clearly displayed. And while I was looking for it, I found this verse. It says, you number my wanderings. You put my tears in your bottle. Are they not in your book? We have a God that's so concerned with our emotions and so in touch with how we're feeling that it's written about him that he knows our tears. He counts them. He has them in a bottle. I know it's a metaphor, but I think it says a lot. I think it says a lot to us that people's emotions and the pains that they feel when they experience particular situations are significant and are worthy of God's attention. So they're therefore very worthy of our attention. And so empathy, as defined by Carl Rogers, the person you saw in the video last week, is to perceive the internal frame of reference of another. Now, these definitions are very wordy, but we'll go through them. Of another with accuracy and with emotional components and meanings which pertain thereto as if one were the person, but without ever losing the as-if condition. Thus, it means to sense the hurt or the pleasure of another as he senses it and to perceive the causes thereof as he perceives them, but without ever losing the recognition that it is as if I were hurt or pleased and so forth. So what that's actually saying is empathy is my ability to try to walk in your shoes without ever thinking that I fully understand. Empathy is about me trying to sense how you would feel in that situation, given all that I know, given the history that you've told me, given the story, given the background, given the situation, me trying to imagine myself in that situation and put myself in your shoes, but without ever falling into the trap of thinking like I completely understand, because I can't completely understand. We recognize others, this is the next definition, we recognize others as empathic when we feel that they have accurately acted on or somehow acknowledged in stated or unstated fashion our values or motivations, our knowledge and our skills or competence, but especially as they appear to recognize the significance of our actions in a manner that we can tolerate their being recognized. So what that means is I know when a person is empathic towards me, when they can start to reflect to me how I'm feeling to a level that I'm comfortable with. So when I sit there and I say, I'm really confused, and the person responds to me and says, well, you sound like you're traumatized. You're starting to understand, but that's a way above what I said. I said I was confused, and you're saying that I'm traumatized. It's not the level that I'm comfortable with. To be empathic is to be able to accurately respond to the person in regards to how they feel to a level that's comfortable to them. And if this doesn't quite make sense yet, it will in a minute. And then the next definition says that empathy is about spontaneously and naturally tuning into the other person's thoughts and feelings, whatever these might be. There are two major elements of empathy. The first is a cognitive component, understanding the feeling, the other's feelings and the ability to take their perspective. The second element of empathy is the affective component. This is an observer's appropriate emotional response to another person's emotional state. So what that's saying is empathy has actually two parts. One part is I can start to recognize why you would behave the way that you would. And the second part is I would start to get in touch with how it is that you got to this point where you're feeling this way. Empathy isn't just about emotion. It's also about starting to see, well, this girl is sitting in front of me and is dressed in this way and is behaving in this way isn't because she was born like this. It's because she got to this point in her life as a result of these horrific things that have happened in her life. So the minute that I can start to be more empathic is the minute that I can start to be more non-judgmental, is the minute that I can start to have more unconditional positive regard for the person that I'm dealing with. So empathy in terms of a formula and what it looks like in a relationship with someone is actually quite simple. And it has a formula, it's that simple. And it's a formula that says you feel because. So what I want to do is I want to invite one of you, any one of you, to just tell me how you feel about anything in particular. I'm not going to ask you to reveal anything deep and dark and meaningful or anything. So, Monica? Okay, so you feel stressed because of university load. Okay, that was quite simple, right? But that's empathy. That's basic empathy. Basic empathy is explicit. It's basically repeating to the person what they've said. But just by doing that, Monica, sorry, she's going to need the mic. But just by doing that, did you feel hurt? Did you feel like I understood what you said?
Yeah.
Okay. Would you have then been able to keep responding? Would you have normally said something else after I said that? You actually did start to speak when I cut you off.
I don't remember, but yes.
Yeah. What actually happens is when you start to speak to someone in this way, what you're saying to them is, I've heard you. I've heard what you've said. And that gives the person the permission and the confidence to actually say something else. So what tends to happen is the conversation keeps going. And it sounds really simple, but it works. It's so incredibly effective. And just by the person starting to explore their feelings and starting to talk a bit more about the reason they feel the way that they do, they start to then process things and think about things that maybe they haven't before. It involves reading and responding to feelings and emotions embedded in the person's non-verbal behaviour as well. So if the person is sitting in front of me like this and saying, I'm really scared about taking that exam, I need to be able to read their body language as well as what they're saying. I need to be able to respond to them and say, you feel really fearful about taking this exam. And they can then start to say, well, yeah. And what naturally starts to happen is the person starts to relax and starts to, like I say, explore their feelings more. So it's important, though, to be sensitive. One of those definitions talks about a response that's appropriate to, that's at the same level as a person's emotion. So although we can use different ways of sharing and highlighting feelings and emotions, we need to be careful. But we can do things like using simple words like, you feel abandoned, for example, or using different kind of phrases where we actually talk about a physical component, to say something like, you feel like you're sitting on top of the world, or you're sitting on top of the world. And we can also talk about what is implied in behavioural statements, so we can say something like, you feel like giving up. Because what that's actually starting to talk about is their behaviour. They feel like giving up, so they're starting to think about no longer fixing the problem or no longer continuing in whatever it is that they're doing. Or by what is implied in experiences that are revealed. So you feel like you're going to get caught. And although you're saying you feel like you're going to get caught, you're implying that there is a fear there, but maybe that person's not ready to hear fear yet. So it's important to neither overemphasize nor underemphasize feelings, emotions or moods. So what I actually want you to do is I want you to have a practice at this. I want you to pair up and sit there and actually just have a conversation and try for just a couple of minutes to practice basic empathy, where you respond to the person. So one person decide to be the counselor, one person decide to be the client, where you just respond to the person by rephrasing or just repeating what they say, and I want you to see what happens. I'll be around, so if you have questions, you get stuck. So we'll do that for 3-4 minutes, and we'll see how it goes. So you can stay as you are. You don't have to be. We don't have enough chairs and spaces to be completely solar and to be sitting face to face. But please participate. Please pair up and do this, and I'll come around and see how you guys go. So we can. Can you turn the cameras off? So how did you all go with that? It's okay, we don't have to record just yet. How did you all go with that? Did anyone find it extremely difficult? Was it hard? Okay, so this is what I'd like to do for anyone who's game. I want someone to be my client. But I want it to be about something real. It doesn't have to be deep and meaningful and anything, but just something real. I don't want a fake story. Come. We have a volunteer. You can record if you want. Is this private? I don't like let it. Okay.
No.
All right. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to just do some basic empathy, and in the next session, in the next part, we'll do some advanced empathy if it keeps going. So let's see how we go. I don't know your name.
Rania.
Okay. I can't forget that. Irini. Okay. All right. So do you want to start to tell me what?
There's a lot of uncertainty in my life, especially with work.
Okay.
And it's causing me stress. Because I don't really know what's going to happen, don't know how to prepare for it.
You need to hold the mic.
Okay. I was saying there's a lot of uncertainty in my life, mm-hmm. in terms especially to do with my work situation.
Yeah.
And it can be stressful because I don't really know what's going to happen or don't know how to plan for it because I don't know what's going to happen.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I've heard you say is because of your work situation, you're currently feeling stressed and anxious about what's happening with work because you don't know what might or might not happen in the future.
Exactly. So I don't know what to plan for and what not to plan.
And that makes it difficult to plan for your future. You don't know where you're going or what to do next.
Exactly.
And you said earlier that was causing you to be anxious? You said, did you say anxious?
No.
No, okay.
I was just saying it's causing stress.
Uncertainty.
Yeah.
Uncertainty.
You don't have, you can't have a plan, this is what I'm going to do and this is the outcome.
Yeah.
You don't know. You can't plan for it.
So because of work and the uncertainty around work, I feel a bit tied down about what I can and can't do in the future.
That's right. You feel like there's no, or I feel like there's no control. No, like not having any control.
Yeah.
You want some sort of certainty.
So I feel like there's no control in my life. I don't have any certainty about where my future is headed.
Yeah.
And that can be, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, a little bit overwhelming.
At times it can be, yes.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Okay. So we'll leave that there. All right. So I didn't... Thank you, Rania. Okay, so I didn't add anything to what she said. I didn't give her any more emotional, any less than what she was explaining. But what happened is it went from a simple statement of I'm uncertain about what's happening with work to I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I feel like I'm losing control of my life, is effectively what she was saying. I guess my question to you, Rania, she's going to need the mic. you can say that. My question to you is, what was it like for you to be sitting in that chair? Did you feel heard? Did you feel understood and validated in the discussion that happened?
I felt like you understood what I was saying, but you didn't really tell me anything I didn't say to you.
Yeah.
You told me exactly what I said to you, but you put it like you understood what I was saying.
Yeah. So initially, the most important thing in a counselling relationship, in a helping relationship, is to feel understood. Because if I feel understood, then I can start to talk about the losing control, the lack of certainty, the future, all those sorts of things. Unless if I don't understand her in the first instance where she's talking about, you know, I don't know what's happening with work and I'm stressed about it, then she couldn't possibly move on to other things that she would have talked about. Does that make sense? So it's very basic. Basic empathy is explicit, is what is stated, basically replied or responded to in a way that basically mirrors what the person has said. It doesn't add, it doesn't take away from what the person is saying. And, you know, at face value, that looks like, what good is that? You know, what's the point of sitting there and just telling a person what they've already said? But what it does is it builds that relationship. It allows the person to feel understood. Allows the person to feel heard and validated. And from there, we can then start to look at some of these other skills in basic empathy. So remember that initial framework that we had of what's going on, helping a person tell their story is about helping the person feel comfortable enough, safe enough, understood enough to tell their story. And so one of the things about basic empathy is once I've done that, once I've reflected, if I get stuck, or at the beginning or at the end of a session or when I'm going to meet the person at the beginning or at the end, just like I did with you guys at the beginning of this, I gave you a very quick summary of what we talked about last week. It's the same thing. Summarizing in counseling is the same. When I summarize, when I tell a person, so you've said this, 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 this and this, the person goes, wow, you've actually heard everything I've said along the way. Summarizing is really important, and it's important too when a client gets stuck. When the person you're talking to doesn't have anywhere to go, they feel like, okay, I've said everything. Once they hear that you're listening and they hear that story, you know, very briefly reiterated to them, they can then continue their train of thought. And it also gives them a new perspective. They suddenly hear what they've said from another person, maybe in a slightly different angle, very slightly different, that they start to see it and start to go, oh, I didn't realize that things were in that order or happened in that way. So that's summarizing. That's one of the first skills of basic empathy. The next skill in basic empathy is identifying blind spots. And blind spots are dysfunctional ways of thinking or acting. And dysfunctional is a pretty big word, but it's where people often fail to see how some of the realities that they construct for themselves are self-limiting. So when a person sits there and says to me, you know what, I can't apply for a new job. I'm not talking about you, by the way, I'm talking in general. I can't apply for a different course. I'm stuck in this course. I cannot get out of this course. There's no way that I can change my career. There's no way that I can change my university course. There's no way that I can change my life. They've decided that. At some point in their life, they've sat down or they've come to this point in their life where they believe that they're limited in what they can do. So identifying blind spots can be something that gives the person an awareness that they didn't have before. It's just simply being asked, having that word repeated back to them when someone says, but more like as a question, you can't, change your university course? Suddenly the person sits there and goes, oh, well, maybe I can. Why can't I? Why is it that I believe that I can't? And they start to actually have this self-awareness, and they start to come out of the self-deception and the choosing to stay in the dark and the knowing and not caring, the mindsets, the internal behavior, a way of thinking that keeps them limited to that path. And so that, in a nutshell, is identifying blind spots. The next thing, and I know that this is on the list of things not to do, but in counseling there is a time to actually challenge. There is a time to stop and to say to the person, well, is this really how you want to live your life? Is this really the life you want for yourself? Is this really the way that you want to deal with this situation? And it's actually challenging in this way has very specific steps. It's designed to help a client do three things, and they are stop, start, and keep going. And simply put, to identify and help the client identify and stop engaging in activities that keep them mired down in their relationship, in their problem or situation, or that keep them from identifying or developing opportunities. So a person, for example, who has a friend who is abusive to them or who is pushing them to take drugs, for example, at some point in time, that idea needs to be challenged. And obviously it only happens when the relationship is strong enough. There is a theory about challenging, and if you can imagine this, if you can think of a relationship of two people as a circle, as a large circle, and one that has many circles within it, the further away the two dots in that circle are, so if you're beginning a relationship, you're in the outer circle, and say the two dots are out here, then you really don't have a lot of space to challenge the person. As that relationship builds, and as those circles come closer, and as more empathy is in the relationship, as the person feels more understood, more heard, more validated, believes that they're not judged, and feels and senses the unconditional positive regard, the more opportunity and the more you're able to challenge, the more that you're able to stop the person and say, is this really what you want? Is this really the way you want to live your life? And so the first thing is to help them to stop engaging in the activity that keeps them in that situation. And then the second step is to start, to help them identify and start engaging in activities that either prevent them from getting into trouble in the first place or in activities that will help get them out of trouble. So obviously, if you're trying to come off drugs, you don't go to a situation where you're going to be sitting around in a big circle and everyone's taking drugs and you're going to sit there and go, oh, no, I'm not going to. It's not really going to be helpful to your goal of stopping the drugs, for example. And then finally is to keep going, which is to identify and continue in activities that manage the problem or develop opportunities. And that's challenging. The next thing, and I'm going through these quite quickly because I want the focus to be on empathy. All of this happens within the frame of empathy. The next thing is reframing, and reframing is simply where I start to put the picture for the person that's differently to the way that they see it. So I go from reflecting exactly what they say to starting to say, well, let's identify and challenge these blind spots in your life. Let's start to look at things that maybe you're not looking at. And all of this is done by invitation. All of this is done very gently and very calmly, and never put across to the person as this is what I think you should be looking at, or this is how I think you should be seeing things. So they're the skills of basic empathy. Does anyone have any questions on that before we get into advanced empathy? Yes. People, sorry, need. Yeah, and nowhere in any of this are they told what to do.
Right. But from their body language, do you think that they show that, hey, I'm lost and I need some sort of practical advice once I leave?
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. The thing about counselling, it's not about giving advice and directing what they should do. It's about empowering the person, helping the person get to a point where they are able to decide the direction of their life. So I don't actually, I can confidently say that there is never a situation in a counselling relationship where I need to tell a person, this is what you should do.
Not directly, but in the way that you say, like, I know that eventually they should come to terms that they can and they have, you know, sort of power to come to conclusion on their own, or even that solution. Mm. But say they've come to you the first time and they need that push or motivation to take that decision.
Yeah. And it's about processing that. It's about working through that. And it's about talking through, well, what's preventing you from taking that decision? You know, and you're right in a way. You know, there is this subtleness of helping the person feel strong enough and brave enough to take that decision. And that's what it's about. It's about providing that support, providing that place to bounce those thoughts, that a person can get to a point where they feel empowered enough to make that decision and to progress in their life. But it's never in a direct way that says, well, this is what you should do. Because once you do that, you've lost them. Any other questions on basic empathy? Yeah.
I just wanted to say, what you think here, is that what you would have done in the room? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
The same way?
Yep.
So is there a reason to, kind of go in circles?
Going in circles?
Yeah. I think maybe...
Yeah, because let's not...
There's a point to that, right?
Yeah, there is a point to that, because what eventually happens is we go deeper, and we didn't actually go in circles. We went to three very different points. We went from being stressed to being a little bit overwhelmed to the sense of losing control. We actually went to three levels of depth as to what's going on. So it wasn't in circles, even though it may appear that way. And that's why empathy is so important and so paramount to any helping relationship, because at surface level, this appears very simple. But it's profoundly deep and it's profoundly powerful in its ability to help the person explore things they may have never, ever thought about before. But basic empathy is limited. It's limited to what a person actually says. And there's a lot more to what a person feels and thinks than what they simply say. And advanced empathy takes it to the next level. Advanced empathy involves reflecting tentatively what the client might be implying. You might have noticed at one stage I said to Rania, I think you said this. Correct me if I'm wrong. I wonder if you said that. And she didn't. And I knew that she didn't. But the reason that I did that was just to test and see if I was starting to be on the right track of seeing how she actually feels. It's about tentatively trying to explore what the person is implying. Advanced empathic listening and processing focuses on what the client is actually saying, or at least expressing, but confused, in a confused way. It's not an interpretation of what the client is saying. Advanced empathic highlights is not an attempt to psych the person out. It's not about an attempt about getting this person to sit in a chair and start to go, what are you really thinking? What's really behind those thoughts? Where's the pathology in all of this? You know, the pathological thinking, I mean. It's not about that. It's not about psyching the person out. It's not about reading their thoughts or trying to work out what it is that's really motivating them. It's about helping the person explore that deeper level of emotion, helping them explore what's actually lying a little bit beneath the surface. Because emotions are like an iceberg. Do you know how an iceberg has a tip at the top and at the bottom is much bigger? Basic empathy deals with the top of the iceberg, deals with what's expressed. So when a person talks about anger, for example, usually below anger is fear. So when a person comes and says to me, I'm so angry, I'm so frustrated that this has happened, I can't believe that she was late another time. Every time I make an appointment with her, every time I ask her for a favour, every time I need something from her, she's late. I'm so angry and I'm so frustrated. There's no way that I can talk to him about what he's fearful of until I deal with that anger first. But beneath that anger, rest assured, there is fear of something. But so advanced empathy talks about what's beneath the surface, what's actually hiding behind the anger, what's hiding behind that confusion or that stress. Is it that sense of loss of control? Is it that sense of that future, I don't know what's going to happen with it? There's more, there's much more that lies beneath the surface. And so some questions to ask yourself in hearing the underlying messages of what a person is saying is, what's this person only half saying? You know, what's this person hinting at? What's this person saying in a confused way? Or what covert message is behind the explicit message? And so how I do that is, like I said, I'm very sensitive. So when a person says to me, I'm really stressed because of university, I'll simply reply and say, so you're really stressed because of university? And they'll go, yeah, I'm really stressed. And you know, we might talk a bit more and I might say something like along the lines of, well, I wonder if that stress has to do with a fear of failure. I wonder if part of that is because I'm really afraid that I'm going to fail this year. And the person might go, yeah, that might have something to do with it. And we might talk a bit more, and a bit later in the conversation I might say something like, well, I wonder if that fear of failure extends to other areas in your life. I wonder where that fear of failure is about, just about university, or is it about maybe fear of failure as a daughter or as a friend or as a wife, or is that fear of failure extending into other parts of your life? Because I get the sense that this fear of failure is kind of taking over everything. And the person might be able to go, yeah. They've never actually said that. But what I've done is very tentatively, very gently, very calmly invited them, asked them. They have every permission. And a lot of the times it happens, they can sit there and go, no, actually it's not fear. It's more about I'm just stressed because I'm usually more organized than this. And that says to me two things. One is, I could be wrong, and maybe there's not fear, maybe it's something else that I need to explore. Or two, I've tried to give advanced empathy too early in this relationship. They're not yet ready to hear what it is that they're really feeling. It's too much, it's too confronting for them. Remember, empathy is about mirroring how the person feels to a level that's appropriate to them, to comfortable to them. And these things might sound, I'm getting a few looks that are telling me that this sounds like it's a little bit much, a little bit overwhelming, but like I said earlier, it's actually quite simple, and it's actually things that we do on a day-to-day basis. We sometimes don't even realise that we're doing it. And it's just about fine-tuning those skills and practising them a bit more to get to a point where they become second nature, they become so normal that you find yourself speaking in this way without even realising sometimes. I hope that doesn't happen for you guys, but it does when you've been counselling people for a long time. But what happens is eventually you start to listen to people in a different way. You start to listen to your children in a different way. So when your child comes up to you and they're angry and they're frustrated, you can actually stop, you can distance yourself from the emotion, you can go down to their level and you can say, look, I can see that you're angry and you're frustrated. I wonder if it's about this. And that immediately brings the tension down. They go, oh, that she understands. Mum understands where I'm coming from. Dad completely gets me. I can have a conversation. I can talk to them. I can keep sharing what I'm feeling with them. They're not threatened by my emotion. They're not responding to my emotions in an emotional way. Does that make sense? You guys are very quiet. Okay. So some of the things about advanced empathy. The first thing is identifying themes. There are usually feelings, experiences or behaviours that are common. There are usually common themes that are mentioned in all stories related by someone. When someone comes and sits down and tells you a story about their life, you'll usually find there's a common thread. If you listen hard enough, you'll probably find that there's this sense of failure, for example, or there is this fear of new things, anxiety about, they might come and talk to you about the fact that they don't want to move, they want to stay where they are, they don't want to change suburbs. And as they tell you about their life, you start to realise that what they're talking about is something that's been there since childhood, that there's this fear of change, there's this sense of loss of control when change happens, and they like to hold on to control. So there's this theme, and starting to identify that and starting to give that to the person and say, you know what, as you've spoken, I've noticed that a lot of the times you talk about your fear of change. I wonder what it's like for you to be constantly afraid of change when there's so much change happening in your life. And you'll find the person suddenly stops and thinks about things in a bit of a different way. They go, oh, I didn't actually realise that this is something, but you're right, it has been there, or you're wrong, or whatever the case may be. It's always gentle, it's always inviting. And the next thing you've got on your list is connecting islands. And it talks about finding things that on the surface appear unrelated. You know, someone might tell you a story about a fight they had with their mother 20 years ago, and might then relate a story about an argument that they're having with their manager at work, who happens to be a woman. And in that person's eyes, they're two completely unrelated stories, but you can see that there's a connection. So So advanced empathy is about bringing those two and saying, look, you know, I've noticed you've told me this story about your argument with your mum, and you've spoken about how you felt small and how you felt like you couldn't express your opinion, and you're now telling me about this situation at work with your manager where you're also feeling like, you know, you're insignificant, or you're a person who's afraid to speak up, to speak your mind. I wonder if you've noticed the relationship between the two stories. And that, again, at surface level, to us might not sound like a big deal, but to a person actually exploring it, that might start to get the ball rolling in terms of them starting to resolve that initial situation and see that these are two separate issues. Sometimes that conversation in and of itself is enough for a person to go, actually, yeah, what is this about? How come I'm feeling this way at work? It might be related to that, but my relationship with my mum is different now. We've gone beyond that. They can then start to behave. They can then start to decide to behave differently in the work situation. It doesn't need to be 30 sessions later and exploring childhood memories and all those sorts of psychoanalytic, you know, theories that you might have heard or come across. And the next thing is about drawing conclusions, using if-then statements, expressing the implication of what the client is saying. Simply saying to the person, so what you're saying is, if this happens, then that might happen? And questioning their logic in terms of how they make their decisions or how they come to a point where they feel that way. Less to more, so the counsellor restates what the client has said with greater clarity, and this can involve taking a relatively safe statement and making it more intense. I don't really care what he says about me, is a common statement. I don't care what people say about me. And that usually means that the person's quite insecure and really worried about what people think and very judgmental of themselves. So taking something that, you know, people say it all the time, I don't care what people think of me, and stopping and actually saying, you know, you've said that you don't care about what people think of you, and I just wonder if that maybe has to do with what you maybe think of yourself and how it is how you view yourself. And I wonder if you fear that if you know what they think, then that might hurt you, and it's easier not to know so you're not hurt. And taking it to a deeper and deeper level and helping the person start to actually explore why it is that they've come to this point and think and behave in that way. Self-disclosure. Look, it's really rare, really, really rare that you would need to sit there with someone and tell them about yourself in order to help them. But sometimes there is a need for that person to know that you're human and that you've experienced similar things. So there are situations where it might be beneficial to the person to actually say, well, you know, I remember being in that situation. I remember feeling that way. And I remember feeling frustrated or confused or lost. And I remember feeling like that was the end of my world at that stage. Being able to tell the person that I'm trying to imagine being in your shoes as best as I can with the experience that I've had in my life. But it's rare. And it can't be about me. It can't be about me sharing my story, and that's the reason for self-disclosure. It has to be that it's something for the benefit and about that person. Has to relate to them. Immediacy is an important one. Carl Rogers talks about immediacy a lot, and it's the purpose of event-focused or here-and-now immediacy is to strengthen the working alliance, and research has shown that too much support can actually weaken the working alliance. I said to you guys, and I keep saying that, counselling is about empowering the person. If you're out to help people, and if you're out to have compassionate understanding, it's about helping that person get on their own 2 feet and be able to stand without your support. And immediacy is about saying, well, you know, we've kind of beaten around the bush a bit. I wonder what it is that's happening for you right here, right now. Or another example might be where a person's sitting there and they're not really interested. You know, they're just kind of, yeah, look, I came to see you because, you know, Tasuani forced me to. Or, look, Abuna gave me your number and I've made this appointment and I've come, but I don't really want to be here. And they're being honest, which I appreciate. But what needs to happen is I need to stand there and say, okay, well, what's actually happening for you right here, right now? I wonder if you can tell me what it's like for you to be sitting in this chair even though you don't want to. And it forces the person to go, okay, I actually have to think about myself. I have to think about how I'm feeling. I have to think about, I have to respond. I can't respond on, Abuna told me to say this, or Abuna said this is the issue, or Tasuna said that this is what I have to talk about. I have to suddenly stop and focus on how I'm feeling and respond based on that. It's that immediacy. It's that call to focus on here and now and what's happening for you here and now. And that can start the ball rolling in terms of where we go next. Confrontation means challenging clients to develop new perspectives and to change both internal and external behavior. But this requires a really strong therapeutic alliance. This requires a really strong relationship. I cannot remember the last time I confronted a client about something. Generally, if you have good empathy, if you have good basic and advanced empathy, and even though confrontation falls under advanced empathy, you don't generally need to use it. But in the times where a client is just coming, for example, every week and saying, look, I just want to know what you think. I just want you to tell me what to do. I just want to know what you think. Just please tell me what to say. At some point, I need to stop and say, look, I've got to be really clear here and let you know that I don't have the answers. And this is about you finding the solution. I can guide you through that. I can walk through that journey with you, but I cannot provide you the answers that you're looking for. And confront them and say, well, what is it about you that makes it so important that I give you the answers to these? And again, I turn the table and I invite them. It's gentle, but almost force the person to look at themselves. It's not about me, it's about them. And encouragement. You know, direct, realistic encouragement is important. Last week we spoke about the woman at the well, and I said to you, you know, he didn't sing her praises. He didn't tell her, you're wonderful, you're fantastic, you're a saint, you're... He didn't. He simply said to her, you're honest. He praised her honesty. Honest encouragement of a person's qualities in a counselling relationship is important. I need to be able to see the good in the person, and at times when they totally can't see the good in themselves, be able to bring that to the surface and say, you know, you've told me about this situation in the past where you were really loyal to your friend. And so I wonder if you're beginning to lose a sense of your value and a sense of your worth as a person. Again, I give praise and I give encouragement, but invite the person to think about themselves. And that pretty much brings us to the end of both basic and advanced empathy. And look, it is a heavy subject. There is a book out there if you're really keen, and it's called it's by Egan. It's called The Skilled Helper. And if you're interested in getting it, it's an expensive book, but it's a really good book. It actually goes step by step. It's called The Skilled Helper, and the author's name is Jared Egan, I believe, but I can double-check that for you. Any questions on advanced and basic empathy? I warned you guys, it's a bit of a heavy one. It's a lengthy one. But I think if you can walk away and if you can just take one or two things, you know, if you can just take that ability to be empathic in your day-to-day conversation, so when someone comes to talk to you about something, you just reframe it to them. You just reply to them and say, look, I just want to double-check. I want to check if I've heard you correctly. So you've said blah, 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 blah. The person will instantaneously feel comfortable, will start to be able to talk to you at a deeper level. And then once you feel comfortable with that, once you feel comfortable with practicing basic empathy and just reiterating to people what they've said, you can then start to tentatively question what they might be implying and start to say, well, I wonder if you're saying this because you're afraid of something else or that this other issue is possibly worrying you. So it's a simple technique. It is really simple. I hope I've tried to make your notes as simple as I can, but I hope that the lecture side of it and the notes side of it doesn't overcomplicate it for you. It is profoundly powerful and it is profoundly effective, but it is also extremely simple. And once you get into the habit of communicating in this way, you'll find that it benefits relationships at all levels, not just those that you help, but like I said, children, peers at work. People who are successful in the workplace are people who are perceived as those who understand others around them. People who are perceived as understanding and empathic succeed because people feel like they get them, they know where they're going, they have a sense of direction about where they're going. So I don't want you to take it as just a counsellor theory. It's a life theory. So we've got a few minutes, so if anyone has any questions about this or anything else, feel free to ask. Just one here.
Another thing with this empathy thing is that we're trained from a very young age to provide solutions. So once you're faced with someone who's coming to you with their dilemma or problem or issue that's on their mind,
yeah.
instead of focusing on what they're feeling or what they're saying, your mind usually races so fast looking for solution. What can I tell them? How can I help?
Yeah.
And I find that to be the hardest thing to work through is to stop that line of thought and say, that's not what I need to do here. Yeah. I need to just simply listen to what they're saying.
Yeah.
I don't have to play a hero here and solve and make their life better for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think my question to that is, well, has that worked in the past? Has us providing solutions to people and telling them what to do, has that solved problems? Has that helped people feel better? I'm sure in some cases it has. But overall, I think it hasn't empowered the person to make their own decisions. And I'm talking about is a different level of helping. It's not just the typical helping where someone comes and says, you know, Ramonda, I really need some advice. Please, please, please tell me what to do. And they tell you what to do. And then you go on. There are situations in life where that's needed. You know, a few weeks ago, I needed sleeping advice about my children. I went and I asked someone and I asked them directly for advice. They gave me they gave me the advice. And I needed that advice to be direct and to answer my question. But there are other areas in my life where that's not the case. And there are other areas of our life where that's not the case. And they're the areas that I'm talking about. I'm talking about when someone comes to talk to us about a problem that's so deep and so profound, and they've started to open up and they've started to trust us with things that they don't normally trust anyone with. Then we need to be really cautious about advice giving. Because like empathy is us not ever really knowing how a person feels, but trying as best that we can to be in their shoes. It's important to always remember that I can never really be in that person's shoes. I can never really live their life and know exactly what it is that they're going through. And like I say, it hasn't generally worked in the past. Advice giving hasn't been very successful in solving situations, whereas empathy has. Empathy does. Yeah.
But if they're coming to
the wrong by whose standards?
Well, if they think that doing a certain thing will help, but it will obviously hinder them from getting to where they want to go.
Okay, can you give me a specific example? Because that's difficult to...
I can try to think of one. Like, for example, a person is trying to stop drinking alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they say, so if I give up my friends that drink alcohol also, I'm going to be left in a really bad place and I'm going to start drinking again, so I'll just stay with those friends and I just won't drink with them.
Okay, so, and that's about then me going, questioning that thought process and saying, so what you're saying is you don't believe you have the strength to give up alcohol on your own, that you need your friends. And they'd say, yeah, I need my friends. And I'd say, but what you're also saying is those friends are going to be part of the reason why you drink. So how are you going to resolve that dilemma? And I'd throw it back to the person. I'd actually force, really encourage the person. I don't want to say force, but really encourage the person to think about that dilemma and to think about their thought process and to think about, well, hold on, that doesn't really make sense. I need to think about it in a different way. I would never say to them, no, actually, you need to give up your friends and you need to be home alone and to give up alcohol. Because realistically, that doesn't always happen. But I need to help them find strategies that best fit in their life. Yeah, and addictions are a bit different. We'll talk a bit more about addictions, but I think that covers what you're saying. There was another question over here. Rania.
Should the way you deal, say, with men or women be, like, done differently? For example, like, say, women, when they tend to... I've heard this. When they come, like, with a problem, they're sort of looking more for understanding and empathy, etc. Whereas men, they might be looking more for a solution and they want you to help there. So with the male, you take a more directive approach, whereas the woman, you don't. Mm. Is there any truth to that?
Yes and no. Men tend to respond better to what's known as a cognitive behavioural approach, which I think is next week. Next week we're going to talk about emotions. The week after that we're going to talk about cognitive behavioural. But yeah, men do tend to respond better to a cognitive behavioural approach, but even that approach doesn't directly give advice as to what to do. It's more about questioning the thought process and helping the person start to think about why it is and how it is that they're coming to the decisions that they're coming and how that's impacting their behaviour. So you're right, in that it tends to work more with men than it does with women. Having said that, even with a cognitive behavioural approach, if a man doesn't feel understood, he's not going to continue in the conversation. So empathy applies to both. Any other final questions? Yeah.
You know that he needs help, and you can't give him much because you can't, and you need to direct him to someone who can help him.
Yeah.
And he found it very defensive, and he take it very badly, and you don't mean it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What you should do?
It's a difficult one because from a counselor's perspective, people who generally overcome their issues are people who are ready to face their issues. So I have a lot of situations where people drag people into my office and sit them down and say, that's it, you're going to talk. You're going to deal with this. You're going to face it. And it doesn't work very often. There are times when it works, when, you know, by the grace of God, we're able to talk and process and they start to build some trust and think, okay, she's not, you know, like everyone else, or, you know, their stereotypes about counselling and their ideas and stuff start to change and we break through those things. But a lot of the times, a person needs to be ready. A person needs to be at a stage in their life where they're willing to say, I'm now at a point in my life where I need help. I need to be able to overcome this, and I'm not really doing it very well on my own, and I might need the help of another person. Before that point, if they're not ready, then it's very, very, very difficult. I'm not going to say impossible, but very difficult to get them to get the help and stay with the help and stay with the process, because this is a process. And like, you know, you guys probably initially when I first started talking about empathy and just responding in an empathic way, I'm sure a lot of you were sitting here going, well, that's not going to do much. But it's about trusting that process and trusting the fact that the more that you do that, and as you continue to do that, it's like an onion. You take a layer after a layer after a layer until you finally get to the core of it. And so a person who's not willing to stick through that process is usually a person who didn't want the help in the first place. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm just saying it's difficult. Sonia, did you have a comment?
Is to show them yourself that you've benefited from this. If you can convey to the people around you or to the people that you care about that you have managed to deal with your own issues through this, that might be the best advocate for them, to give them hope that they can also deal with their issues if they take the same approach.
Hmm. Yeah. And that you're right, Tiswini, that's where self-disclosure can come in. When a person feels that the person that's trying to help me get help is not just out there that, you know, thinking they're better than me and they know what's best, but they're actually empathizing with me and they realize that this is something that we can overcome. They can relate to.
I think also when people see that you do things differently now, like, for example, you used to get so angry before at all the little things, but now you've managed through getting counseling yourself to find a way to deal with all the issues that you used to
snap at.
And if people find that you're more calmer, you're more happier, you're generally happier in life because you've gained this kind of help yourself. Mm-hmm. I think that the best way to convince people that this will work for you too.
Yeah.
Mentality that this is very connected to the mental problem. And when you say to someone you might need help because you may be depressed a little bit or anything.
Whatever, as
he said, I am not crazy, I am not mad. Well, what are you saying?
Yeah. And I think that's the purpose of these lectures, to start to dispel that myth that, you know, to sit down with someone and to have counselling of any nature that means that there's a mental health problem and that, you know, it's going to require medication and psychiatrists and doctors and being strapped to a chair and all those sorts of movie ideas that we have. You know, they're even not just movie ideas, they're movies from like the 1920s or something. They're not even recent. But, you know, that whole philosophy of, you know, counselling and psychology is only for crazy people. But I think from our lecture last week, I hope that I've been able to prove to you guys that that's not the case, that it's very much a Christian-founded way of thinking. It's very much about compassionate understanding. It's not about fixing the person. It's not about me knowing more than they. So I agree with you that that myth is out there, that belief is out there, that counselling and anything related to it is only for nut cases and crazy people and people who are sick, etc., etc. But we can only work on that one person at a time. So I guess what I'm saying to you is my hope is, you know, 30, 40 people in here maybe have an impact on another 30, 40 people, and it grows that way, that we start to dispel that myth so that we as a community can start to grow and start to overcome issues that are here and exist but don't need to be. They don't need to be. So, but yeah, that's a bit beyond my control. There's a question here that I'll come to here and then we'll finish.
I think it's just an addition to that. Isn't that why you refer to them as clients, not patients?
Yeah.
Because they're not in need of, like...
No. I don't have patients. I'm not a doctor. Yeah, they are clients. And in my mind, they're equal. They're not... And there's a question over here. Sorry, there was a question here first, then we'll go to the back. Shireen had a question.
Yes. You mentioned earlier that someone came to you telling you about a priest that did something they didn't like or so, and when you defended them,
I didn't defend them, but I said internally I wanted to, yeah.
Okay. And yes, we feel that sometimes, that we want to defend the other side.
Yes.
That is to comply with the Christian teaching not to judge the other person and so on. So how do I make up that equation?
Yeah, and that's a difficult one. What you're saying, and tell me if I'm wrong, I think what you're saying is what happens in a situation where we know the other person might be in the right, for example, and we want to defend that person because we don't want to feel like we're sitting there judging that person. And my response to you is it's not so much about what that person does, it's about helping your discussion continually focus on the person you're talking to. So rather than spending a lot of time talking about what the other person did or what the other person said, it needs to continually come back to, well, what was it like for you in that situation? How did you deal with that situation? What did you think in that situation? What was your response? And continuously, as much as that person will try, and it's a cultural thing, as much as that person will try to drag you from that and take you to the other person and have you have an alliance with them in agreeing that the other person's in the wrong, you resist that. And you always bring it back to them. So you never actually condone nor condemn another person's behaviour. You're always dealing with the person in front of you. So you always invite the person to, okay, well, that's how you saw what happened. What was it like for you? How did you respond? What did that do for you? How do you think you would respond next time? What impact did that have on your life? Continually helping the person to see that this session, this conversation, isn't about anyone else. It's about them and only them. And that's how you avoid the judgment of others as well.
Sometimes I try to share them the positive thing of what the other person done.
You can try, but in trying to do that, you'll probably lose them because they need to come to that conclusion themselves. And a lot of the time it's not about what the other person did or said or could have said or didn't do. It's about how they reacted to it and what they felt about it and about how they deal with people in general. So, yeah. There was one last question there and then we'll wrap up.
Last week you covered the topic of judgment.
Yeah.
Where do you draw the line between judging them and discerning the truth, knowing that they could be lying?
Yeah. Absolutely.
So where do you draw that line?
It's more about knowing that what they... It's a fine line, look, to be honest. And it's about knowing that what they say is the truth and what they believe is the truth for them. And I've always got to help them question that thinking. So I've always got to be... You know how I said to you, these are the stages, but throughout those stages there is this common question, there is this how are we going question that sits through all the stages. This appraisal that's constantly happening, and it's me constantly saying, reframing back to them, saying back to them what they're saying, giving them opportunities to see it in a different way, to process things a bit differently. What tends to happen with people who do lie as a defense is the more you do that, the more you express empathy, the more it starts to come out. And the more that they are in a situation where they're telling the truth, they don't even realize they're doing it, and then they start to face the thing that they're really afraid of. Because a person who lies compulsively is usually doing it for a few reasons. One is they could be taught to do that from a young age. And then, you know, lying is such a common thing in their home and it's no big deal, so it's just become a habit. But a lot of the times, it's as a way of protecting themselves. So as you talk more and as you constantly question and as you constantly reframe what a person says, they start to get to the truth. It's not about me confronting the person and saying, hey, look, I know you're lying about this situation, because then I've lost them. But it's more about, well, what was that situation? Tell me a bit more about it. It's about trusting my instinct as well. And that's not about judging, that's about helping them to get to a stage, again, where they're able to face the truth of their life. So yeah, I hear what you're saying, it's a difficult one. Okay, so I think, what, Rania? Okay.
Regarding your list of barriers to communication, does this apply to children as well in the same way, like raising up children, or it's in a different approach?
Yeah,
like?
Look, I think so. I think to be empathic with children, and that is such a difficult thing for a parent to do, even with a 2.5-year-old, I know it's a difficult thing to do. But I think being empathic to children is very powerful. And I think it teaches them that they can come and they can talk to you about anything. I remember, very quick story, my lecturers at college, I had a married couple lecturing one subject, and they were talking about group processes. But at one stage, we were talking about empathy. And I remember her saying that her children, from the time that she started doing counselling when they were very young, have grown up and have always said that they could talk to their mum about anything. And so she's got this open, honest relationship with her children where they feel like they're heard and they're validated every time that they speak to her. And she said, the only thing I ever did was just repeat what they said. Half the time I didn't even know what they were talking about, but I just reiterated to them what they were saying, and 99% of the time that solved the problem. And she's right, it does, especially with children. Once they feel like you understand them, kids from a very young age, from birth, start to relax. If you see a newborn crying and they're hungry, once they're fed, they're comfortable. You understand what they're talking about. Whereas if they're crying and they need a change and you feed them, they're going to keep crying until you understand. And it just applies throughout life, you know, from birth onwards. If we feel understood, we can then resolve our own problems. So I think, yes, I think these barriers are still there. Obviously, as a parent, there's a place to give advice and there's a place to give direction. But I think we can't do that as parents unless we're empathic, unless we have that strong connection with our children that they feel like they can trust our advice. They feel understood, so they're willing to receive our advice. So, yeah, I think they do apply to some level. So we'll leave it there. If you guys have any further questions, I'm happy to stay back and we can chat one-on-one. All right. And so next week we're going to talk about emotions in more detail, and we're going to talk about what they mean and how we deal with them, especially if we're uncomfortable around emotions. And then the week following we'll talk about cognitive behavioural stuff, which we touched on today. Thank you guys. I'll see you all 7:30 next week.